Welcome to Ain't Slayed Nobody. This is an actual play podcast intended for adults and may contain material that some people find disturbing. Please see the episode notes for content warnings and listen with care. Howdy, and welcome to our Y'all of Cthulhu Season 1 Q&A session. This is our ride into the sunset. We collected questions from listeners across various platforms and answered as many as we could here, or at least as many as we felt like doing. This session does contain foul language and a ton of spoilers for Y'all of Cthulhu Season 1, so if you haven't already, go listen to about 30 hours of Ain't Slayed Nobody, then rejoin us here. We could not gather the whole team for the Q&A, but we have a very nice selection. Chuck, who played our drifter Johnny Rhodes, Wes Davis, who played Jeremiah the Prospector, Will Baser, who wrote for the show, including a bunch of lore, and also played Professor Wilkinson for a bit, and I am Cuppy Cup, your keeper of arcane lore. I'm tempted to put in the theme music, but it's a Q&A, so I'm not going to do that. Let's just jump right into the questions. Nate P. asks, how many of the players have had RPG experience before this game?
The first time that I actually met Will in person, we both live in Austin, and I had decided that I wanted to play some D&D, and he had also recently made that decision. And so we were like, we should start playing D&D. We'll get a group together. We went to a one-shot being held at a local gaming store here in Austin where it was for people who were new, and they gave you like a pre-gen character and you sat for this one-shot, and it was the worst tabletop role-playing experience that I've ever had.
I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And that's the difference between the two of them.
I mean, it was hilarious, but not good gaming. But it was interesting, and I was super still into it. Even though I was like, I absolutely would never play with any of those people again.
There's a little bit more to it. It's like we came in, we were expecting a one shot. The guy who was running it was expecting us to go there for multiple sessions. It was...
Oh, he thought we were doing like a year-long campaign. He had misread
the room.
Invite or something. Yeah, he did not read the room.
That's kind of like how season one went, right? 8 episodes turned into 21.
Yeah, basically. That was however many years ago. We started a campaign where I was the DM and we played here locally. That was the first time I had ever played D&D, and I was the DM, which I understand is not the way you're supposed to do that. And that game is the only experience that I had prior to Ain't Slayed Nobody.
Hold on. Didn't we do a session? You, me, and Cup?
That's a different story. That I wanted to get to on another question. Somebody asked about where did the name Ain't Slayed Nobody come from?
Oh, yeah. Let's incorporate that now from Crack Spider. Yeah.
So we started Ain't Slayed Nobody actually originally as a D&D podcast. And we recorded 2 sessions or just 1? I don't remember.
I think it was 1 and I was the GM. And that's why it didn't go anywhere.
It's on Patreon, right?
Yeah, I was gonna say patreon.com/aintslayed.
I need to go listen to it. I'm a patron now.
I'm a patron too. I'm gonna go listen. Join our patron.
The maiden shit you were doing was actually really funny, Wes, with my character.
Oh, that's right.
Oh man, I forgot about all
of
that.
It was really good. We just scheduling didn't work out and the whole thing died out, but we had started that whole thing under Ain't Slayed Nobody, which for the many people who listen who don't know, the name comes from a long, long, long running college football joke of people calling into the Paul Feinbaum show from Alabama and saying such and such team ain't played nobody, Paul. And so Ain't Played Nobody is just a running joke in college football. So we made our D&D podcast Ain't Slayed Nobody.
We had about 100 name recommendations back and forth, and then Jay, who played Lance, just pops in and says, Ain't Slayed Nobody, And we're all like, yep, that's the good one.
Yep, that was it.
Jay is just a wizard when it comes to puns. It's unbelievable.
That's true. It's true. Yeah, it is right in his wheelhouse.
Oh, this is a good one from our friend Dan Flukes.
He's an old Bullcast fan, so yeah. He's an OG.
He's been with us for a long time, Dan Flukes.
Yeah, I like that guy.
I like him.
I do too.
He asked a question everybody can answer. So this is, what was your most memorable or favorite moment? And for players, it's a two-part question. He wants your favorite moment for your character and your favorite moment for another character.
Can I start?
Yeah, I hope you do.
All right. It's my favorite moment of another character because it was the most brilliant thing and it was a wonderful move. And my jaw was on the floor when he did it. And it was when we were on trial and we were all about to die. And then out of his ass, Chuck pulls a letter opener and claims to be a U.S. Marshal.
So we're going to do this now, huh?
I'm so happy to be here for this.
It's my favorite moment that ever happened. And Cup was like, no, because I didn't think of it. You dick.
That was the only session of this entire podcast that ended with a weird tension in the air.
There was a little weird energy after Lance died, I'll say. But yeah, that was the weirdest for sure. That was the one where I was like, yeah, that didn't go that well. But I think that episode's pretty good.
No, it's all excellent. It's all excellent.
I remember Chuck and Cup both texting me almost simultaneously complaining about the other.
Well, I was kind of complaining about how it went, if I remember it right.
Yeah, but, I mean, it doesn't sound as good when you say it like that, but
that's
yeah.
True.
Wes, answer the other half of the question. What was your favorite Jeremiah moment?
Oh, man. I had a lot of fun with him, but I mean, that first episode was just too much fun because it was figuring out who he was. And at that point, I was just there playing a crazy miner from Idaho because that was the fun thing to do. You have a body in shooting the guy in the femur and then kind of arguing with Cup. Like, the thing that gets lost on me is that guy shouldn't have died.
Oh, God. Here we go. It's all
No. We would have gotten so much more information. And that's why I specifically said, I'm going to turn his femur into mist. We would have had time to talk to him. You don't die that
before
fast.
He bled out.
I'd have had like 8 minutes to like have a conversation. Like, he's dead. Fuck you.
Obviously, Jeremiah has a ton of lines that everybody loves, as they should. My favorite one is from that first episode, but it's sort of a throwaway. But the way you delivered it and the timing, when you said, "What's Game of Thrones?" Every time I Game hear of that, it fucking makes me crack up. I don't know why that's so funny to me, but your delivery was flawless on it.
I liked the first episode because we were still, everybody was feeling it out. And I think the characters were fun in that phase. I love where everybody took their characters. I think that all of the characters got to really, really come out and come into their own and figure out who they were. I had a lot of moments that I liked with Father Flint. I think Father Flint was a ton of fun.
Mm-hmm.
That pairing when we were sneaking around the hotel was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. So yeah, those are it.
For me, for the other characters, I have a lot. When Jay was having conversations with Dust Devil, when Lance was having conversations with Dust Devil, like all those conversations were so good. I don't know why, but the way he played that is very, very funny to me. But also
Jay's
was
funny.
Very, it was a, and it was a lot of exposition while being really entertaining. I really liked that whole thing. I really liked playing my little duo with Father Flint near the end when we were sneaking around Colin Brock's house. I thought that was a lot of fun. For Johnny, I was thinking about it. And I think my favorite moment with Johnny was when it's like sometimes when you're playing these games, I just really like it when the dice help tell the story that you were trying to tell anyway. It's just funny that way. And so when Lance smacked Johnny to break him out of that bout of madness as they came out of the cave, and Johnny went and turned around and smacked Lance back, but I missed completely. And it was so perfect. I just really liked that moment because that's exactly the way I was picturing that actually happening. And it just really made me laugh.
I think that is my favorite session that we've had. It might be my least favorite episode, but I think it's my favorite session. The one where we had the big chase on Baylor Peak.
Yeah, that was fun.
Oh, yeah.
That was an episode where I never felt like I didn't know what I was doing, which I felt that way many, many times in just about every episode. It was good. It was constant action and Jay starting fires, which is always a delight.
Jay's a pyro.
And another thing, you reminded me of this, Chuck. Another thing about the way I edit that might not be that fair to Jay is that I probably cut 500 puns from Jay from the season.
Puns are interjected like every fifth line of dialogue.
Yes. It's like breathing to Jay.
Exactly. I left some, but I really did leave like 1% of total puns in the season, which isn't fair to him. Will, so what's your favorite moment?
What's your favorite Wilkerson moment?
Yeah, give us some professor stuff.
Maybe trying to figure out what to do with the bone pile. The bone stretcher was probably one of the best parts.
Yes.
Of that entire little mini arc there.
And the fact that we made such a thing of the bone pile that I'm sure was just like a setting thing, but we're like, no, let's fuck with this bone pile for like an hour and a half in real time.
I forgot about that.
That was a difficult session because I knew what was happening and I was trying to like not get it away.
Yeah, Wilkerson's weird because he's a live NPC, and I think we're going to try to have more of those in season two.
I liked that.
I think it's okay, and I think that Will played it well.
Yeah, he did. He didn't, like, overtly take control or anything. It was fun.
The way that Will did that makes an argument for doing that more often. I think it was cool.
Appreciate that. And trying to decide amongst the other, all of y'all's, like, my favorite part. It's kind of like trying to pick my favorite child here. I'm trying to... The femur mist probably was one of the best intros to a show anybody's ever done.
That was a good definitive moment to let people know what they were getting into. Yeah,
femur mist set the tone, no doubt.
I guess I'll go with the easy one and just say that because I think that's probably it.
So my favorite moment, this is really hard for me because... I have favorite moments for all the characters.
So give us your favorite moment for every character.
Oh, God. Now I have to remember moments for every character, though.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite moment for Johnny is easy. It's the grenade in the caves. I think that you prepared me for that a little bit, Chuck, but I didn't know exactly what that was going to look like. So with the acetylene bomb that you made, I was
very proud of myself for that.
That was like a really cool moment. And it was a good horror moment, too. We didn't have that much, like, you know, with the ghouls bearing down on you and you had to make this throw. I just thought that was really cool.
Obviously, the way I rolled Johnny and put his character together, he sucks at everything combat. He doesn't know how to shoot a gun. He has a lot of knives, but he doesn't actually know how to use them at all. He was base on all of those. And so as I like to play my D&D characters by sort of thinking outside the box beyond combat, I was trying to think of, okay, what can, because we ended the session shortly before that canteen bomb. Yeah. So there was like another, it was for the next session. And so I was sort of looking at my inventory, like, what do I have that could do anything that could fix this? And you had given me that lantern. What was that lantern called? Whatever it was, I Googled it because I was like, what is this thing that I have? And it talked about how it worked by dripping water on whatever that thing was, something carbide, and creating acetylene.
Oh, it was a carbide lamp. That's right. Yeah.
A carbide lamp. And I know, and I work in the construction industry. I know what acetylene does.
Yeah.
I saw the explosion of that acetylene plant in Houston. And I was like, wait, that's an explosive substance. I can do this. So I started Googling and watching YouTube videos of people dropping that sodium carbide into water and then setting it on fire. And I was like, this is a thing.
Yeah, that was cool. I mean, Johnny had a lot of cool moments. As did all the characters, but that bomb like always stands out to me as I don't know if it was a turning point in the season, but it was definitely like, okay, we can do cool things through this show and improvised things. And I think that that stands out to me. For Jeremiah, it's like so many little moments that add up. So obviously the episode one stuff everyone's mentioned. I really like how much, I think not just Jeremiah, but Wes hated Sam. So that whole like ongoing exchange between the two characters is something that I really enjoyed.
I didn't hate Sam.
I hated Sam. I know I did.
Yeah, Chuck hated Sam too. So it was fine. Well, remember Jay tripped Sam at the dinner table and I cut it from the episode because I didn't want people to hate Lance.
And then later we took that cue from Jay.
Yes.
And we just started dunking on Sam left and right for no reason.
Uh-huh. For Father Flint, my one-on-one session with Brandon when, well, I guess Jay was there as a zombie.
Oh, that whole scene was so good.
Like Brandon just let loose in that session and he was awesome. And it was such a good session. I think that whole series of his death is probably my favorite set of moments for him. Obviously in the cave when he lost his shirt and we had the appearance role, like that was fun. All the drug use was fun. So it's kind of, I don't know. I'm not giving one moment, but I think his death was probably my favorite. I think for Ellie and Lance, it's a shared moment. Their whole exchange with Brock in the mansion when they sat down in his office and the revelation came out about Lance killing her father. I just thought from a role-playing perspective, they both did a great job with that.
That was the first scene that started to feel like a movie to me.
Yeah.
It had sort of a real gravitas to it that was really nice. And up to that point, unforeseen.
So Bony Fingers asked for everyone, including the players, did you know how dark the story was going to get?
Well, like when we started, I, and I'm pretty sure everyone else except Cup, had never heard of Call of Cthulhu. I didn't know exactly what we were getting into. I believe Cup's description when he was said how what he wanted the tone to be like was Scream, but in the Old West, was how you put it.
I like that.
Oh, God.
So I didn't really know how dark it might get until I played Fairyland. That one was written and run by Scott Dorward, and that shit got dark and very, very creepy in that way that Scott Dorward can do.
He's ridiculous.
Well, if that's what we're playing, then I guess conceivably our show could end up like that too.
Yeah.
Right now it's just, you know, femur mist and people fucking around, but eventually this has got to come to a head.
Yeah, I think Scott's regarded as probably the darkest of all the Call of Cthulhu writers. And we've experienced that multiple times. But I think that playing more with Scott and Graham made me feel like the game could get darker than we were making it, probably around episode 11 or so. Really, in Oviedo, it started to turn into a darker story, which makes sense. I mean, most Call of Cthulhu games go through a progression.
Compared to those sort of smaller arcs that I've done, I feel like our season actually did the same thing those smaller arcs do, just on a much more stretched out time frame. The big first half of it is very silly and you're all fucking around and you have no real idea of what's going on. You're getting dropped hints and you're just trying to sort of proceed. And then somewhere along the session, it takes a turn and things get very dark and then they start to get very desperate and then everyone starts dying and maybe someone survives, but probably not.
I think once Lance died, it really started to escalate in terms of...
That certainly heightened the stakes for the rest of us. It got a little less fucking around and a little more like, oh, is my character going to make it?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Wes, were you expecting it?
Kind of, yeah. After playing games with Dorward, I think the improv Halloween one gave me a pretty good idea of how fucked up things get. Murder Shack started to give me an idea of where things would go, and Unland just showed me where this mythos goes, because there was a question in there that, like, I'll just kind of answer throughout, and it was from Crack Spider, but it said, did you know much about Lovecraft or Lovecraftian lore? And no.
Me neither.
I didn't, and holy shit. I wasn't ready for what cosmic horror really meant. I'm a little existential myself, and this has given me new throes of anxiety. I'm really thrilled to to know the things that I know about this now. It's like, are you going to read Lovecraft? Fuck no. Are you kidding me? No. No, I'll get it through the game. And so, yeah, it got dark. I don't think I expected it to go that hard, but I like the way it went.
I always thought it was funny how in the first episode, Jay's like, well, we're in a horror, so something's gonna happen. Should we cut this guy open?
Should we cut this guy open? We're all like, what?
At some point around episode 6 or so, Will and I had a discussion about, wouldn't it be funny if it was consequential that they didn't cut him open? And yeah. I tried to put something in the finale to call back to that by having P. Tinkle have mist released from his body, kind of indicating that, hey, maybe there was something inside Maxwell Posey, but I'm certain that landed for zero people. So do you want to talk a little bit about what we had in mind, Will, for the Wicker Man and the Green Stone?
That was sort of like a warding off of, like, Sparky understood, like, Ngepgathga is here, and he built that there to sort of have, like, a ward against Colin Brock's guys. I believe, Cup, we decided that there were more of Colin Brock's guys to come and get the body, but some of them didn't make it.
Yeah, like, that's why the ambush was so weak in episode 1, was mm-hmm. because Sparky and the unseen cultists had taken care of them. And I think that the heart in the Wicker Man actually belonged to one of Brock's men in the way we had discussed it.
Right. They knew something was going on, but they weren't quite sure. Sparky had a good feeling because of, you know, him and Kate's background, you know, the research they had done beforehand. And so they kind of knew what was going on and kind of built that as a way to make sure that they couldn't go south, basically.
And this also ties into Quaylon's question about Kate and Sparky's backstory. I think most of that backstory that got fleshed out was incorporated in some way into the show, because it was really just about them coming over from England to study at Miskatonic University. And Ellie had the dream, right, at Miskatonic, that kind of just established who they were, with Sparky being the professor, Dr. Henry, and with Kate being the student studying Egyptology and all these things. Quaylon, Will, wanted to know kind of what was the point of all the Egyptian imagery, which, you know, it didn't really bear out to be that important in the end. And then I'll tell you what I thought was important about it at my superficial level.
So a lot of the story that we built, we knew wasn't going to make it into the show. It's there so that there's it's kind of like the deep ties to tie other things together. But again, I put into the Discord and Y'all of Cthulhu spoilers, there's a document kind of detailing who Ngepgathga is, the lore behind him and the prophecies behind him. In short, basically Nyarlathotep tortured a woman, by making her see basically everything that ever happens. She discovered some prophecies, then wrote them down. Kate was the first one to figure out what they meant, or what some of them, the ones that were that she could actually find, meant. It was basically a prophecy of Ngepgathga's birth. And that belt buckle that Johnny found was basically the story behind that. Like, that was basically that prophecy was, like, Kate was able to figure out what this ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics meant that nobody else was able to. Once she figured that out, Nyarlathotep found her. Then she was running around the world with Dr. Henry, who was another guy who really knew Egyptology and a lot more stuff like that. They were like, oh, there's all this stuff happening in New Mexico because of the Dark Mother, and went there, and then everything happened.
Yeah, and they ran into Brock. Brock found his little gem that he wore around his neck, and that's how mm-hmm. they all got linked up. And I think that the Egypt piece, to me, I really just wanted the establishment that this is an old story It's not like these are things that are just now starting to happen. I wanted to talk about how it's old. And I also just liked the imagery. I tried to incorporate the Egyptian motif into the courtyard in Brock's mansion and kind of replicated Johnny's belt buckle into the fountain. So really just kind of keeping these, this consistent imagery and these connections to Egypt. See, I think I'm probably different than Will in this way, in some ways, in that I don't think like the audience has to know what's going on. It's just kind of a feeling or a theme that's running throughout, because the characters would never know what's going right. on.
No, I get that. I completely respect that. But yeah, that's why you saw a lot of the imagery of the heron, I believe is what it is.
The ibis.
That's yeah. what it is. Ibis in all that stuff, is because the ibis is the Egyptian hieroglyphic, I believe, for Ankh. So you saw that. Yeah. And then you're talking about how, Colin Brock found the little gem, the story of Mgep-Gathka's birth. I want to basically say it was like started in, you know, was basically in the area that became New Mexico. And so like that sort of had like the essence of Mgep-Gathka, which is where Brock found it, and why the whole ceremony start is in there, and why there is an essence of the Dark Mother in that area, because they had the cultists there and whatnot. So sort of everything kind of came together around that, and finding that token of Mgep-Gathka kind of basically buried itself into Colin Brock's mind and made him, you know, want to free an unborn god.
Okay, yeah. So I think that actually answers quite a lot of what Quaylon was getting at. So Steamtastic Vagabond, did the players mostly follow along to the ideas or constantly derail plans? Back to the letter opener.
All of that.
Were there instances of players poking at an unimportant detail or creating a new plot line? I think the most unimportant detail that was poked at was the rock in the desert that was Chekhov's rock that had very little story consequence. It was something that I thought was fun to have, kind of a meteor that, you know, potentially a Dark Young could have traveled on.
Oh, that's right. But you cut desert. A lot of that out.
Yeah, it was very long.
In real time, we spent like an hour and a half, 2 hours at that rock mm-hmm. that ended up being like 8 minutes of podcast.
Yes, but it was a good 8 minutes.
We were super into that rock and figuring out what's going on there.
Rock meet mama. But I don't think there was anything that had to be completely redone. Olvido, Will had laid out NPCs and I had borrowed a town map and we had talked about what might be at each location. So I think that was more of a sandbox than the rest of the adventure. So I wouldn't say you derailed it, but certainly like we didn't know what you were going to do or in what order you were going to do it.
I think one thing that y'all didn't follow along was like certain little clues here and there. Like, I don't know, Alex being like, hey, do you want to go look at this bookcase? No, I'll burn it.
Oh, that's a different question. I've got to give credit to whoever asked this. Yes, Alex G. Yeah. What is the direction or plot point the cast didn't head toward that you really wanted them to? And that I think that would be Will's. I knew that would be Will's when I read the question.
Yeah, I was basically going to explain what was behind Pete Tinkle and basically explain Alex's backstory. But yeah, instead it was burned to the ground. So.
Admittedly, she didn't decide to burn it. I accidentally caught the building on fire along with myself.
Yeah. Yeah, she just ignored it.
She just wasn't interested in searching those books.
And I said, I think it was Father Flint, Brandon, I said that there was some like design on the floor, some pattern. He was like, cool. that whole room had like a portal. There was a gateway in there. It was like this elaborate thing, but it never came to
neat.
Bear.
Uh-huh. This is a group that will role play all day and have a good time with it. But if you try and force us to a library use role, you will be sorely disappointed.
Yeah, the error there was probably putting it in books. because there was a revolt on that, I think, immediately.
Yeah, there is also, there's a lot going on in the church in the town that I think ended up not being used.
Oh, right. I repurposed the church for all the Jeremiah stuff.
Yeah, we had to repurpose a lot of stuff because y'all went immediately to the big house and we were like, well, they weren't supposed to go there for a little bit. So, all right, let's heading right into the mouth of the.
Yeah, Sparky was at one point going to be in the sheriff's office. So we just kind of moved things around as you did things. That's what game masters do, right?
Yeah, that's how it works.
Three ways to find a clue kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mm hmm.
You know, at the time, I wasn't sure how that was going to work out, but I think it ended up being the best role play for Alex and Jay there, and also did do that kind of tone switch over to horror. So I think it all worked out for the best. And we got the wolf scene out of that, too, as the others investigated the basement there. Someone asked a question about that. Actually, I think they just asked me to say wolf. Mendoci and Yankee.
What do you want you to say?
Mendoci and Yankee said, cups say wolf, and then cast say wolf. Who said it better? Wolf. So
it's so good every time you try to say it correctly.
Look, the wolf pack caught on. That's all I care about.
Yes, the wolf pack is my favorite thing now.
It's a thing. Mendoci and Yankee asked another question that I actually think is pretty interesting. Not that that wasn't. What kind of horror really gets in your head and makes your skin crawl, hair stand up, fingernails peel back, teeth curl, tongue wither?
Descriptive.
For me, the stuff I don't like is like the Saw movies.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the gore and stuff. That's all fine. There's something about the situation of it and the inevitability of it that I really hate. And I just, all puts me on edge. I'm not okay with any of that.
Man, something about, it's not necessarily like watching it. It's what it can make your brain do. The way Scott Dorad describes ichor and things like that, like crawling into your body and pulling your soul down. And like, it's just, the torment of 10,000 years of being decayed into it. It's like, no, Jesus Christ. That kind of stuff keeps me up at night.
I hate all horror. I don't know why I did this podcast.
Jesus Christ.
I absolutely hate horror movies. I cannot watch a horror movie.
Life is terrifying.
My fiance loves horror movies, and her sister
hates
comes over.
The podcast.
The opposite of Will.
They'll watch horror movies downstairs. And I'll be upstairs Googling what's happening in the horror movie because I don't want to watch the horror movie, but I want to know what's happening.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
So I'm upstairs be like, oh, okay. Wow. That's awful. And that's sort of how I kind of get into like the horror here is like, I can deal with like reading some things. I'm squeamish and I hate visual horror. But yeah, so I guess that's how I can do this. But like, Cup, when you started like putting in a lot of the sound effects and really getting into the horror, I was like, I hate our podcast.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how you felt about the last four episodes or so.
No, they were great. They were great. I loved them. I also hated them.
I think the Johnny Foot was the one that I was most worried about. Like, we might lose some people who were in it for the laughs.
If it wasn't clear, I was super uncomfortable with that whole recording session. I was like, this is a lot. So I basically like created a Saw movie for myself, which is ironic in retrospect.
I love horror movies. So it was always my favorite genre as a kid. I wanted to make horror movies.
A long time ago. What was it? You had the number one Scream fan website.
I knew you were
going to
bring that
internet.
Up.
He was it. He was the number one on the whole ass internet.
Can we somehow get Matthew Lillard on as a guest? Because he plays
God,
a lot of D&D.
I would love that. Yeah, he's amazing.
But yeah, Matthew Lillard, I ran a Scream website for a long time. I think I had some unreturned messages to your agent. We were getting guests like W. Earl Brown, who played the cameraman Kenny. I had a deal with IGN. We got advertising money from them, which was a big deal back in 1997.
This was the weirdest way for you to play out your crush on Courtney Cox.
But I think if there's one thing I don't like in horror movies, it's slow torture. I think I have trouble with slow torture, which, again, going like back to
people
the foot,
cutting their own foot off.
Yes.
I have that kind of trouble. Foot. Like any kind of torture. Yeah. I don't like torture.
I'll tell you one scene in our show that did it for me, like was did me in, was the little girl and the mom in the house.
Yeah.
How you described that cup gave me chills.
It was creepy.
That was pretty creepy. I almost got the actress who voiced Nina to sing there, but I thought it might be too much money and too much for the audience. I liked that little scene too.
You did well.
Cooper has a Johnny question. Will Johnny be coming back? And Midnight asks, will we know what happened to Johnny in the end? It's possible we could get a Johnny cameo or a Johnny kind of separate arc, I think, in the future. Cooper asked, how did that 100 feel? And I think that was about Brock's 100. We had a lot of 100s.
Yeah, but that one had a certain amount of chutzpah to it.
Yeah, I was excited. I like when the players roll 100. I like when I roll 100. And I didn't roll that many. So to do it in that moment, I will say, after the initial kind of surprise and excitement, I was a little worried that the finale wouldn't be long enough if Brock died right there. So, but then I convinced myself that if I didn't have enough, I would just smash 20 and 21 into one episode. Maybe that's originally what I wanted to do anyway. So yeah, I got over it pretty quickly. But we bypassed a ton of combat that I was expecting to have in the final scene there.
And I'll be honest, from my perspective, I was pretty sure going into that there was going to be some cool fighting and stuff, but that Johnny was almost certainly not going to prevail in that situation. Of all of our characters, I don't think Johnny was the one to go into the big final fight with no skills of any kind that were applicable to fighting or anything. So I was like, oh, well, hey, we've got a fighting chance here now.
Before the final three with Wes, Alex, and Chuck, I wanted to make sure that there was an out for all three of you. Granted, Jeremiah's was very, very difficult to accomplish, but that there was a route to survival, just because then there are real stakes. It's not just automatic death. So I was, I was pretty happy with how it turned out.
Yeah.
Alex's rolls against Brock were just brutal. With the two bonus dice, she had like a 70-something% chance of prevailing and still lost that roll. I was happy with how that turned out too. So, sometimes I don't know in the session what's going to play well in the final episodes. And a lot of the time I'm wrong about what's going to be a good episode and what's not. So Q10 Fanatic, another Bullcast fan, I think, who I really like, asked about what note-taking occurs off-screen to keep track of the story and loose threads. This is where we get exposed, I think. So I think it was around session 8, Will, that we tried to put together the loose ends that we needed to resolve before the season ended.
Oh, yeah. Those.
I made a notes document on my computer that just had a bulleted list of these are things we need to tie up before this thing ends. And around episode 19, I revisited that list and added everything new that was a potential plot hole to that list and tried my best in 20 and 21 to make sure we addressed the things I thought were most critical. I felt like there were things that could be left hanging, like Birdie, which some of you've asked about, where I felt like it was more powerful if the mystery was there about kind of the origins and things like that. But certainly Will and I talked about that a lot earlier in the season, what Birdie might be, what Birdie could become.
And even after it happened.
Yeah, even after the fact, like what just happened, because people were asking about it in the chat. Somewhere in the middle of the season, I had this thought about reburying Birdie, which once Johnny gave Birdie away, became a possibility.
Oh, my God.
I think that kind of changed it, Chuck, when you decided, okay, I'm gonna give Birdie to Ida. Birdie became less relevant to the end game at that point. And I was really happy with kind of leaving Birdie mysterious and reburying her to become whatever she was meant to be. And of course, Graham Patrick played a big part in the end game. And that epilogue in my mind is kind of Birdie choosing what to become. And she decides to reunite with Ellie in her new Spectre form.
Oof, Chuck, how's that feel? That she chose the mom over the over you. She chose Ellie over
Johnny.
Dude,
I'm a parent. They always choose mom.
Chuck knows. Anonymous asked if Flint and Jeremiah were together.
Are we shipping them? Is this what's happening right here? We're shipping Flint and
Jeremiah?
I think
they're together in hell.
Yeah, if you want.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it. I thought they had a really cool bond, and I thought that Flynn and Johnny had a cool bond, too. Dr. Occult had asked in the Discord about whether anyone put together the whole Sparky story with swapping the mind of the Dark Young and the actual Kate, and I'm not sure. I think the vibe I'm getting is that not many people did pick up on that, but I feel like that was the most complicated thing I injected into the story, but I didn't feel like it mattered because I thought it worked either way. But basically the idea is we established that Sparky is able to mind swap. So presumably Sparky could mind swap Kate with the Dark Young. And then there was the sequence with your dream with Wes, with Jeremiah's dream with Kate, which was me trying to, maybe you don't need to foreshadow when it's happening in the same episode, but kind of foreshadowing what Kate had become with the root network under the ground, and that you were basically, I like this, the way they said this, on the astral plane being swapped with Sparky. So it was a mix of Jeremiah's dreams and Sparky's dreams at that point was kind of the vibe I was trying to put off there. And that it ties in, the Kate monster ties into James M's question, which is, they're curious about how we worked with voice actors in the recordings. When you were playing, did Cup voice those characters, and did the voice actors have to record bits to be added in? However it worked, they really liked Ida and Kate, especially as brilliant characters. I think I told Chuck, people don't realize how much creepier Kate is when I'm voicing Kate.
Yeah, in your just normal ass street voice.
It really is fucked up.
It's just Cup calling me little sapling and stuff.
Well, I started Kate trying to do a British accent, but I think it faded very quickly.
Oh, that
was
a huge mistake, yeah.
I think you did like four lines of that.
Because I guess in retrospect, I ended up having the most conversations with these voice actors between Ida and Kate.
For sure.
Now, for me, those were all conversations with Cup that I was having. In fact, the cutting the foot off scene was a one-on-one recording session one night.
Yeah.
That we put together while there was a legit ass thunderstorm tearing through Houston. So we had background thunder that was really nice. And we actually had to stop that recording for like 20 minutes so you guys could like shelter in place.
Yeah, there was
a
tornado warning. Yep.
So we stopped and then we started again 20 minutes later. But yeah, it's, I think that it worked. In my opinion, it worked out. And maybe some people would disagree because I like these types of stories and podcasts and games, frankly, to be very fun and funny. And so if you listen to them again and picture me talking to Cup, you can see how Johnny was just kind of, it sounds like he's fucking around all the time, but it was because I was just hanging out with Cup. And then he brings in these two voice actors, the woman that did Ida and the woman that does Kate, who are phenomenal and bring this huge amount of gravitas to what they're saying. And then it just sounds like me being a dipshit on the side.
I love that. But it's my favorite thing.
I liked why it the way it played, because I like it to be fun. If we were both super serious, I don't think that I would have enjoyed those scenes as much. And so, yeah, I like the way that that all came out. And I like the way it makes it sound like I'm being kind of a flippant jerk to Ida when she's being super serious about all this occult stuff, but it's because I was talking to Cup.
I love that. I like that. That
I think it's great.
Because you would never talk to Daisy Hobbs that way, but you.
I would have been super intimidated by her because she's Ida and she scares me.
Yeah. And so Daisy Hobbs was Ida and Victoria Hogan was Kate. And they're like legitimate actresses. So, you know, replacing my part with legitimate actresses, to me, like, I love that because it really brings the character to life. And I think that's probably the most extreme production shine that I try to put on the show, is to replace voices that I am completely inadequate at pulling off with people who are qualified. And I think it helps a lot. I could see where some people would think it takes away just because of the authenticity angle. But I think that, you know, the spirit of the session's there, but you're also getting this really cool performance layer on top of that. For season two, I do want to have more live NPCs. I've already talked to Victoria about doing some of that, where they're actually acting out the part live rather than doing voice replacement with me.
When you sent me the initial second session, sort of like the rough draft of it, I was not expecting you to use a voice actress for Kate when they were reading the journal. As soon as I heard that, I think I did like a dance around my house about how excited I was and how hyped I was about what you had just done. That was such a cool thing that you did, Cup.
Yeah. And the thing with that is, once you do it, you have to keep doing it. I didn't expect at that time to have that much Kate. She obviously became a major player in the end game as well. But it is like, you know, Scott Dorward's a good example of someone who, even without a range of a lot of different character voices, just has like some acting chops and inflection where he can pull off every NPC and it sounds fine. That's not really my strength as a keeper. So I felt like I was going to lean on some people who were better qualified to especially do female roles. But even some of the male roles, I was like, you know what? It'll be more fun if we have someone good as Dust Devil.
I got really attached to whoever you were using for Dust Devil. I kind of got a kick out of him by the end. I was sad to see him go.
Yeah, Danny Scott, he's awesome. And he also was the guy you fought with at the saloon in Las Cruces. He's great. Yeah. So I was fortunate to be able to find good people.
I was going to say, do y'all remember when Cup tried to do the women in the college?
Yes, I do. That it was stayed amazing.
That's in the final cut.
Is that in the final cut?
Yes. It's in there.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So if you doubt my decision to do the voice replacement, go listen to that episode because I left that in. Well, related to NPCs, so I did play Colin Brock and leave myself in. Midnight asks, how did you make Colin Brock such an unlikable asshole? I think I joked on Twitter I just played myself, but I do think it was important to make Colin Brock condescending and kind of smarmy, and just to make him say things that would be irritating, because I was trying to create a lot of tension with Alex and Jay. And I felt like to make that work with Colin Brock, he just had to come off a certain way. And I was really happy with how that turned out. I don't do a good Southern drawl, but I did my best. And I just tried to think about what would piss off the players, what kinds of things I could say. Well, I think one thing that made him an asshole is that he was a cheater. So he used magic when you were supposed to be playing straight up. So that's immediately going to make people hate him. And he also, you know, was ruthless and also cocky when it seemed like they had opportunities to kill him. He was very dismissive of what they were capable of. So mm-hmm. It was just, he was a fun character to play. Definitely my favorite NPC, that I played. Well, Kate was my favorite, but the one that's in the final cut, Brock was my favorite. Serpent or Prime asked, I don't know how much y'all care about firearms, Chuck and Wes, but seeing as the Old West was all about customized GATs, what specific firearms did you picture various PCs or NPCs carrying? Did you think about your guns, what they looked like?
I'm going to abstain from this one. As we've established, Johnny was shit at all combat. And I think at one point you gave him like a 22 rifle.
Oh, yeah.
The bolt basically action. A nothing that I never even used once anyway.
So. You shot into the void once, I think.
That's right. I did just fire it into the void just to see. I was using it as like a scientific instrument.
And well, you had the femur, Mr. West. Did you have much thought about your 45?
No, I really didn't. I guess kind of like a mother of pearl handle.
La-di-da, Mr. Jeremiah.
Yeah, well, I mean,
I was all about pearl handles too. And Graham was too. We all love pearl handles.
I don't know. Other than that, the pickaxe, I really needed more detail on the pickaxe. I think it could have, it had the potential to be like Stanley Spadowski's mop in UHF.
Oh my God.
Nice.
What
reference.
A wonderful reference you just threw out there.
And that's just kind of like, that's kind of what I thought about when he lost it. I was so fucking mad.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I gave you a shitty replacement axe.
It's like Thor's hammer. He should have been able to reach out and get that fucking pickaxe. Like from like he's the only one that can lift it.
I back up Cup's decision on that. We had to punish y'all somehow.
Shut up, Will.
Going through those chains. Cup, good decision.
I think the last person we haven't asked any questions from is Greg C, who did ask how long it takes to make an episode from start to finish. So it's a tough question because there are story elements and prep elements and conversations and recording sessions. But what's easiest for me to quantify is editing and production. I think that it's variable. So I do want to say episodes 20 and 21 were special. So please don't expect that level every time for season two, because I will die. I probably spent over 100 hours on those two episodes combined, just trying to make them the best that I felt that I could in the amount of time that I had. I think an average episode is probably 20 to 30 hours of work from start to finish. And it sounds like a lot. But if you're working with 3 hours of audio from the beginning, it takes 3 hours just to listen to the fucking thing once. So imagine going through, cleaning all the audio, shuffling different parts of the scene, getting the voice actors in there, putting in layers and layers and layers of sound effects and music, reworking it, you know, going through again, getting feedback on it. It just is like, and exporting takes forever. So it's just like this endless process that I think Will would tell you, especially in the first half of the season, like, I would hate episodes up until the last minute. Just like, this one's not good. This sucks. This is going to be the one that I'm not proud of. And then there's always kind of this light that goes off at a certain point when it's like, if I put 8 more hours into this, this is going to be a good one. So I would just like fucking stay up all night and get it done. So the podcast has been taxing, to say the least. So I'm trying to figure out exactly how season two is going to work, which is why I was begging.
Yeah, so the way that Cup decided to solve the problem of the podcast being too much work is to attempt to do double the amount of recording.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a little better at it now, though, and we get more usable audio from each recording. Like, the last two episodes really...
Oh, I can fix that.
The last two episodes pretty much came from a session or a session and a half, so it wasn't like that at the beginning when episode one's 4 hours and the final episode's 56 minutes or whatever it is. So we get much more usable audio. But yes, Greg C also asks how you're going to play with 8 players in season two. So it's not going to be 8 players and me in the sessions. It's going to be a split party situation, kind of interwoven stories. I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but it's going to be manageable. But that is why I'm begging for Patreon money to do biweekly episodes, because it is a killer. And, you know, things are a little easier to explain on the home front if you're getting something out of it and not just losing money all the time. But, you know,
save Cup's marriage, give to the Patreon.
I think two things. One, a common phrase said to Cup by fans needs to be, go to sleep, Cup. Just take a damn break.
For sure.
But the episode's got to post on Tuesday. unless it doesn't, man. If you tell them that it doesn't, then it doesn't.
Yeah, I did miss some deadlines and let some things go when life got a little heavier. But it, you know, it's I like the final product enough that I'm willing to put those hours in. But I did get in the habit of after season one ended, like I cannot sleep. Like I'm so used to staying up until at least 3 o'clock at night that if I go to sleep at 10 or 11, I'll wake up at 2 in the morning and I can't go back to sleep. So sleep's a problem. That's fair. Whoever said that, Chuck.
That was Will.
No, yeah, you're now giving me ideas for my scenario that I'm going to write about your life.
Oh, are we going to play Cup of Cthulhu? Cup of Cthulhu.
Good. That's my Twitter handle. Nice. Thank you for the plug. Chuck may have brought this up early in the season, but the other thing about me, other than getting really into hobbies, is that I burn out about a month after I start them or 2 months after I start them. So this is actually kind of a miracle that we finished a season of Y'all of Cthulhu because it was 18 months of nonstop work, basically. And yeah, it really is a miracle. It's really a testament to how much I enjoyed the show that I would not let it die because it's that good, I think.
When Cup approached us about this thing, obviously I was like, yes, because I want to play games with my friends and I like tabletop role-playing games and I think they're excellent. And like Will and I still have this D&D campaign that we never finished that maybe we someday will, who knows? But also on the side, there's sort of that thought of, huh, if Cup is going to do this thing, I would like to get in on the ground floor because yeah, he goes hardcore into things and sometimes you've just got to go along for that ride.
Even if it goes down in flames in 2 months,
you never know. You never know which one you're going to get. But the point is that you try.
That's funny. I think we'll wrap up the Q&A there. It's pretty close to a tidy 1 hour episode. Thank you for listening and thank you for your questions, even if we missed yours. Of course, we'd appreciate your support on Patreon at patreon.com/aintslade. If we reach $2,000 a month over there, we will release bi-weekly episodes in season 2. Forget sleep. Support the show. Get more episodes. We are machines. Buy t-shirts at slade.me/merch. They are beautiful. They're soft. They're made by Home Field Apparel. They really are cool shirts, and Homefield's a great company. So slade.me/merch, pick up a Push the Roll shirt, Femur Mist, NMA, NMA, Y'all of Cthulhu, Ain't Slade Nobody. We've got it all over there. And maybe Wolfpack shirts coming soon. We'll see about that. Chat with us on Discord at slade.me/discord. You can complain about our answers here or even dig a little deeper on Discord. slade.me/discord. We are Ain't Slade on all of the social media platforms that we care about. And I would like to thank Will, Wes, and Chuck for participating in this session.